From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Albany earlier this month when the legislative session, I should say, what month is it? It's July, last month now, when the legislative session wrapped up. Wow. Now, throughout the month of May, it seemed that the session was kind of moving toward a rather placid finish. But as usual, there was some drama surrounding certain pieces of legislation at the last minute. Now it's time to take stock of state business. Now, Monday, we had the chance to do that with the minority leader of the state assembly, Republican Brian Kolb. Today, we welcome Assembly Majority Leader, Democrat Joe Morelli. Joe, welcome back to Connections.
Always great to be here. I understand today's a big anniversary here, so I'm excited. Congratulations.
Yeah,
happy birthday.
Yeah, that's the next hour. We will be celebrating next hour 30 years ago today. WXXI AM 1370 signed on as the NPR affiliate, and we're going to shame my colleague Alex Crichton with some archive stuff, which is just fabulous.
Good for you.
We thought we didn't have any, but we do. So we had Brian here on Monday. We've got you here today. And for our listeners, if you want to jump into a conversation about state business, or it's a great time to have access to one of the Joe likes to hear it said, one of the more powerful people in Albany. It's true. The number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We talked to you back in January. Now, what is the biggest accomplishment of the last 6 months and in this session, Joe?
Well, I think it continues to be the shepherding of our fiscal situation in a positive direction. We finished our fourth on-time budget this year, which, in some places perhaps wouldn't be greeted with the kind of acclaim worthy of passing budgets on time, but it is important. It hasn't happened in 40 years. And I think the important thing about it is not only were they done on time, which gives obviously a great deal of predictability to organizations that rely on state funding, but was also done without resorting to balancing the budget through fiscal gimmickry, through increased taxes, through borrowing. This was done by continuing to monitor spending largely and actually a reliance on fewer tax dollars because we've reduced taxes in most income categories to the lowest level in 40 years. So it's been a big deal. I think the governor deserves a great credit for it, but I think the legislature as well has partnered and managed to find accommodation on that. So I think that continues to be the story. From a substantive point of view, our a continued emphasis on economic development in upstate New York is another thing that I'm very, very proud of, something I've worked on for a very long time, and it's great to have as a partner with us a governor who is committed to it as much as those of us who live in upstate New York and represent it are.
The governor frequently says taxes is maybe priority one for this state. You have Brian Kolb, Republican, saying tax relief was a big accomplishment in the recent session. Joe Morelli says tax relief is an accomplishment. You still have the business community saying we're the worst state to do business in because of the tax climate. Why is there a disconnect there?
Well, I think partly because first of all, let me just say, as it relates to the premise of your question, I'm not sure everybody in the business community says that.
But you're right.
There are people.
No, that's fair. That's fair.
And I think, it's hard to perhaps fully appreciate this, but turning around a state the size of New York is really like a super tanker turning around. It takes a little while. There's a fair amount of inertia that's moving us in one direction. But you look at this in terms of trend lines, where we've gone. We've reduced corporate franchise taxes. We've eliminated manufacturing taxes. We've created up startup zones that will link entrepreneurship and innovation together in a way that we haven't seen before. Those are all very much directed at trying to improve the economy, particularly of upstate New York. So, the governor has said, he's fond of saying, I've heard him say it many times, that we don't have a future as the tax capital of the United States. That's not where our future lies. We really have to continue to work on tax relief. And we've done it for homeowners as well, property tax relief, not only the cap, but now the freeze that's in place. So these are all efforts designed at that. I think some people would like to see us move at a faster pace, but I always think of it this way, that when the governor is attacked and legislature attacked on the right for not doing enough, and yet we're often attacked on the left as having given too much to corporate interests, then probably if you're in the center there somewhere, you're probably doing the right thing. And my guess is that the vast majority of New Yorkers believe that we have to encourage job growth and we're doing the right kinds of things to get there.
All right. So update us on the corporate franchise taxes. What happened in the last 6 months, especially when it comes to the manufacturer's tax? But let's talk about all of those things.
Yeah, we did a number of things. One is we exchanged what was a bank tax, which applied only to financial institutions. Since New York is still arguably the financial capital of the world and still wants to be the financial capital of the world, eliminating the bank tax and now applying the standard corporate tax to banks was more of a benefit for them in terms of audits and making sure that they understood what their tax liability isn't necessarily a tax cut. It just helps a more efficient, cleaner, leaner system in terms of tax policy. We eliminated the manufacturing tax for all New York manufacturers. Not all manufacturers calculate it using the manufacturing tax. Oddly enough, there's different ways of doing it. But for those that do, it's now zero. We eliminated a number of other smaller taxes. But the important thing is we've also given a property tax break. So now if you're a manufacturing facility that owns a building and pay property taxes, you get a property tax a break on that portion of what you pay in terms of your tax liability. So a lot of this was driven towards making it easier for businesses to do business. And as I said, the Startup New York program is now in full swing. In fact, the University of Rochester had its campus plan approved for Startup New York. I think it's 100,000 square feet. They have a whole host of businesses asking who do research with U of R that links that research with entrepreneurs. We've seen RIT make an announcement. They were the first one approved. Datto was a company that's coming from Connecticut and bringing 77 new jobs to it. We're working on Eastman Business Park. So there's a lot going on, and tax policy is directed, in our view, towards making it less cumbersome, less a tax burden. We changed the estate tax to bring that into conformity with federal law so that we don't discourage particularly family-owned businesses from reorganizing in such a way that their wealth leaves the state of New York. So there's a lot that's been done in that regard.
I was going to ask you to be specific about manufacturers, and you already mentioned several specific companies, job numbers, et cetera, because I'm always curious when you're putting together this kind of a change in policy or change in taxation, are you doing it because you sort of nebulously believe that this is going to be good for manufacturing, or are you hearing from companies that say, look, it's New York or X, and you make it more competitive and we're there?
Well, I think it's both. I think fundamentally we just believe that we can't compete if we're too high taxed. In other words, there's only so much capital put in. And when you're building or designing or expanding a manufacturing plant, that's a significant investment in capital. So we have to be as attractive as possible. But we're also hearing from companies that want to come here. They're not always large manufacturers. In fact, even if you look at auto plants now compared to an auto plant 40 years ago, you might have 500 workers in an auto plant to produce, have the same output that you now need with 25, 30 workers. So it's much different. But I think there is, on a national scale, and this certainly applies to New York, not only an economic development imperative, I think there's a national security imperative to build things in the United States again. I sponsor a bill which actually organized labor in the AFL-CIO, is very supportive of Buy American Steel. So when we're doing construction of buildings in New York to the greatest degree possible, we want American steel to be the undercore of that instead of Chinese steel or steel that's imported into the United States. So I think there's a lot to do. But I think manufacturing, it won't be the same as it was 50 or 100 years ago. Clearly, the numbers just aren't there. We use a great deal more technology and robotics to build products. But building things again, and making use of the assets we have in this community, material science knowledge on in terms of clean energy. There's so many things that the medical devices that we know about, as well as pharmaceuticals that will come out of the University of Rochester Medical Research Center. I mean, those are all about the future. And we are at a point that we're not only doing that, but you look at what we're doing in Eastman Business Park, and we appropriated $33 million for an advanced manufacturing plant in Batavia, which I think – you know, if what we're hearing from national experts is true, has the potential to transform all of Western New York and the Finger Lakes, it will be thousands and thousands of jobs, as many as 10,000 predicted if this takes off in the way that we believe it can. And we've made a big investment towards that goal.
And I certainly understand the concept of a strong economy has to build things. You got to make things. You know, not to the way you got 65,000 people at Kodak. Again, like you said, we're not going back there.
Right.
But you got to make things. But if I own a small manufacturing company, maybe it owns has 50 employees, and down the street, somebody owns a small business, 50 employees, not a manufacturer. Are you telling the manufacturers that their work is more important because you're taking their franchise tax to zero, and other business owners may say you're favoring an industry?
Well, it's a fair question. I think it's one that is asked often of us as we sort of try to design tax policy around investment. And the great thing about manufacturing is it is different in some respects. First of all, the wages and benefits paid to workers is typically much higher. But manufacturing, if you look at what we would call sort of the the indirect costs or the indirect benefits and the multiplier. The multiplier is something we measure. How long does a dollar stay in a community? Manufacturing dollars multiply far more than most other industries. So, and as I, my earlier point was, they have to build a facility, not easy to move. There are all kinds of additional benefits to having manufacturing in your community, and it benefits all the service sector jobs, hopefully, that will follow with it.
My guest for the hour is Assembly Majority Leader Democrat Joe Morelli, and if you want to join the conversation, you can do that, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, last week on this program, we heard from the Let New York Work Coalition, led by Brian Sampson of Unshackle Upstate. They have a six-point platform backed by a number of school superintendents, mayors, and business leaders. And first, if we could, I'd like to play a cut of what Brian Sampson said, outlining some of their targeted legislative reforms that he says are still needed going forward. Let's listen.
Unfortunately, over the last 3 years, the greatest failure of this governor and this legislature is the fact that they have provided almost no mandate relief. The other thing that it's important for people to understand is that when you contribute to the state retirement system, you're contributing a percentage of your salary at the lowest end of your pay. So you pay when you first start, but when you collect at the higher end, the average of your last 3 years. So it's a system that is not perfectly set up, which is why a defined contribution system would be much better, because it's not a defined benefit that's fully guaranteed by the taxpayers.
That's just one of the prongs there, and there's a couple of points there. So let's start with this. What do you make of him saying that the biggest failure of the last 3 years is no mandate relief?
Well, first of all, I should say that Brian Sampson is a friend of mine, and I deal with him quite a bit, and he's a very bright guy and very thoughtful. So, in fact, I talked to him just 2 days ago about some things that had happened during the legislative cycle that I think he was pretty pleased about. I think when you look at the biggest mandate that counties in particular have faced over the years, and they have complained about the most, has been Medicaid. And we have actually made significant strides in eliminating Medicaid as a burden on local governments. They haven't eliminated it entirely, but there's no growth now in the Medicaid burden. So as Medicaid grows, the cost to counties will not grow. We've locked it in at a level of 2 years ago. So whatever growth is happening, which means over time, as county budgets continue to grow, as cost of living grows and the cost of expenditures, that Medicaid will be a shrinking percentage of their budget. So that's a significant relief, not to mention administrative costs for Medicaid are now entirely borne by the state of New York as well. I think, you know, respectfully, my friend, I think we have made strides on mandate relief. But honestly, I think our attention has been how to get our own fiscal house in order, how to make sure that the state of New York isn't spending at the kinds of levels that we have in the past. And we'll continue to work on that. And I think we'll continue to look at the burden of local governments. But I'd also say that we have instituted Tier 6. To Brian's point about the pension system, the factors that he described may apply to earlier tiers in the pension system. They do not apply to Tier 6, where you have an indexed contribution that you'll have to make. As you make more money, your contribution will go up. And we've learned some lessons from previous controllers who encouraged us to make richer the pension plan, how that turned out to be not such a great idea, particularly in light of some of the financial market challenges in the last decade. So I think we've made the kinds of repairs to that. And you'll start to see the way our pension system works, Evan, is, as I'm sure you know, but your listeners may not, is we've instituted different tiers. Each tier is less generous than the one before. The reason is the state constitution prohibits us from changing the pension benefits of people who are already in the system. So we build new tiers on it, and each successive tier applies to new hires and new employees of public systems, whether it's the state or local government. So I think you'll see the benefits of Tier 6, which was enacted a couple of years ago. You'll start to really see as older workers age out and retire, new hirees will be done under the Tier 6. So I think that's been a significant benefit, which you will see over time. So those, I think, I think have been mandate relief. I sponsor a bill that Brian is a big supporter of on unfunded mandates with Senator O'Brien. So I'm not in any way unsympathetic, but I don't know that it's entirely fair to say that we haven't done anything on mandate relief. Clearly, our focus has been getting our own house in order, but We have done enough, not enough, but we've done some significant things as it relates to local governments.
We're going to get to the phones in just a second. They also, the Let New York Work Coalition, wants to essentially wipe out WICs and scaffold laws, for example. And that's getting a little bit down in the weeds, but I'm curious to get your take on that. I mean, certainly you've got labor very concerned about some of these provisions. What do you say?
Yeah, it is interesting. New York City school construction is not bound by WICs. So we do an exemption area for New York City school construction, which is a big, big
Yeah, is that fair?
No, it's not fair. And I think there are modifications you could make to WICs. You know, I think what they're proposing is actually to level up the exemption statewide, I think to $100,000, I think was what the number I saw. I may be wrong on the number, but I think there's some value in that. And the smaller projects should not be subjected to WICs. It is important to note, even in the private sector, they typically use a WICs-like model where they have and WICs basically, for listeners, is it requires on certain public projects that you have prime contractors, HVAC, mechanical, electrical, has to be done as prime contracts rather than as subcontracts without a general contractor. And we think we get the best price. We think while there are sometimes challenges in coordination, that actually makes it a more competitive and lower cost process. And that's why it's used largely by big businesses, even in the private sector, without any requirement to do it. But I think there are some modifications we could make for the smaller projects where it probably makes less sense. Scaffold law is something I do support Brian's position. I think we should move to a comparative negligence system. It's a bill that I have authored and continue to advocate for. I've had a number of conversations with my friends in labor, particularly in the construction industries, about ways that we could ensure public safety or safety of workers while not having to have this system, which has really driven the cost of construction projects in the public sector dramatically higher than, in my view, they need to be.
Let's get our first phone call. This is Sue in Fairport. Sue, thanks for calling. You're on with Joe Morelli.
Hi, thanks. I understand that the workers' compensation funds were raided to balance the budget. Are we going back to the 1990s when people were committing suicide because their cases were dismissed, denied, delayed?
I believe what you're referring to is there was a deal a couple of years ago to use what workers' comp indicated was an excess fund to help balance the budget. It was a one-time deal. I do not know, Sue, of challenges with the workers' comp system. If there are specific instances you want to pass along to the office, we're happy to talk about them. I'm in touch a fair amount with unemployment and workers' comp systems. I used to chair the insurance committee, and although they don't directly didn't come under my jurisdiction, I was involved in a lot of the conversations with them. I think there are some real challenges to workers' compensation in terms of rates and rate increase, but I don't think it relates to the specific point that you're talking about.
I thought that was this year that that the funds were raided for.
No, there was an agreement a couple of years ago to take.
No, I understand that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
This is this year.
I don't recall. I think I would know that, but I apologize if I missed it. But I don't think that was the case this year.
All right, this is Paul in Brighton. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Two quick questions. Mr. Morelli just mentioned with the pension system how tiers are added as other workers age out and new ones come in, and I think he mentioned that would take a constitutional change to make some progress on that. I haven't heard any discussions in years about a constitutional convention. Is that kind of a dead issue? Is that any possibility that could happen?
Well, actually, Paul, it's a great question. Under the current state constitution, every 20 years, there is a referendum question put to the voters of New York on whether they want to call a constitutional convention. And I believe in 2017 will mark the 20th anniversary of the last time question appeared on the ballot. So I believe in November of 2017, New Yorkers will be asked the question. If they vote yes, then we will convene a constitutional convention. And obviously, if they vote no, we will not.
Do you think that's something your peers would welcome? Are we going to be encouraged to come out and vote for that? Or, again, I don't remember what happened 20 years ago, but is there a campaign that comes along with that helps people know that that's on the ballot, or is that kind of buried somewhere?
Well, it's an interesting question because there are people are always a little concerned about opening constitutional conventions. Pardon me.
Yeah.
Because they put everything on the table, so it typically is the case that everybody likes certain things in the Constitution,
sure,
and they don't want it to change. For instance,
if you only do it every 20 years, I think the expectation would be there's going to be a bunch of stuff on the table.
Correct. Now, there's nothing that stops the legislature from convening a constitutional convention any time during those 20 years, but mm-hmm, every 20 years at least, the public gets to make a decision. So, for instance, you mentioned we talked about the pension benefits, which are guaranteed under the state constitution.
Yep.
That would be in play. But what also would be in play is the constitutional provision for the health and safety of the indigent, of the poor. We're one of the few state constitutions that requires support, and we call it the safety net program, that requires the state of New York to take care of the neediest citizens in the state. The other constitutional provision, which I think people would be very concerned about touching, is the requirement that there be a system of common education, which has now been part of a court of appeals case successfully tried that the state hasn't done enough for public education. That would be a provision. There are environmental provisions. So there's an awful lot to it. And so oftentimes people are concerned about losing some of those rights and privileges and benefits. But it will certainly heat up, there's no question, over the next couple of years as the time gets closer and the question is put to voters. And there's nothing the legislature needs to do to put that question on the ballot. It's automatic. And I believe 2017 is the 20th anniversary of the last question.
Dale, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Dale.
Yeah, hi, Mr. Morelli. I work for the local building trades. I won't say which one, but I just want to, A, thank you for your hard work on the school construction bill. That's a lot of jobs for us here locally. I just want to know when we're going to get Phase 3 passed, sir.
Well, Dale, thanks for the call. Thanks for the acknowledgement. It was an important piece of legislation in my mind. We are in the last stages of Phase 1. It's important to note that Buffalo completed all of its phases. They've spent $1.2 or $1.3 billion on repairing schools in Buffalo. Syracuse is ahead of us. Had we not passed the second phase of the facilities modernization plan, we would have gone at least a year, maybe longer, with literally no work on our schools and state funding, which is available, basically being left in an account not to be able to be used. I think we've put enough protections that will prohibit and prevent any of the abuses which have been alleged to have happened among some of the subcontractors on Phase 1 and investigations that are ongoing in that regard. But I think we've done enough, and I applaud the mayor and the school district for their work in helping us get this done.
All right, we may circle back to that before the hour is over, but let's grab Keith on line one. Keith, thanks for calling Connections.
A couple of tough questions. About 18 months ago, maybe a little bit more, you were on show when I called in, because I think back then you were in charge of the state insurance commissions, or you were on some committee that were.
I chaired the insurance committee in the assembly.
Right. I called about a change in our healthcare policy, where the healthcare policy that my wife's employer provided did not meet the state's minimum requirements, but yet the state gave him a waiver on it. And I was concerned about it, and I sent you the copy of the letter in the email. And I got an email from your office that was a canned response stating that you're working hard for me, blah, 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 and never addressed the issue. That was one thing.
Was it a commercial policy, Keith?
Caller,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. The previous caller was talking about the city construction, and, you know, I believe if the city needs it, to go ahead with it. But I'm part of that, too, and my insurance costs to do some of the work for the city are more than 10% of my total cost. 10% just to meet the absurdly ridiculous levels of insurance that are required. I'll give you an example for illustration only. Why would a landscaper who puts in the trees and the flowers when the job is all done need $4 million worth of liability? But yet that's a requirement.
Well, you've asked a lot of questions. They're all good ones. Let me start by saying I apologize if we didn't answer directly a question that you asked us about health insurance. I'm not aware of any waivers that are given by the Department of Financial Services to allow companies to have policies that don't include the basic coverages allowed or required under New York state law. Now, they may be a self-insured company, and if they're self-insured, the state of New York can't regulate them by federal law. We're not allowed under something called ERISA to regulate those. So it may be that case. I'd be happy to maybe I can figure out a way to get you my email address, my private one, and I'll figure that out.
Well, you don't have to, but it didn't meet the letter stated that it did not meet the New York State's minimum that companies are supposed to supply.
Well, unless
healthcare. But that's that's water over the dam.
Okay. The issue of landscaping or whatever it is on a public project, some of this may be
it's the insurance.
Yeah, you said liability costs or liability insurance. Some of that, and it's a public job, right? That's what you're talking about?
Right.
Some of that actually may get tangled up in the scaffold law, which we talked about. If you're putting in trees, you may be working at elevated heights. I don't know. Obviously, it'd have to depend on what your liability policy is. But that's probably not healthcare. That's probably all your different insurances, healthcare, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, and certainly liability insurance. And that's one of the things. I'm sorry.
What I just wanted to illustrate was that everybody has to have comp, but everything, all the levels of insurance for the cost of it. So I had to buy additional insurance because other jobs you don't need such absurdly high levels of insurance. And then the total people you have to insure. I had to insure a bank on Wall Street on this. The total insurance bill for this job is more than 10% of my total cost, which I don't care because it gets passed on ultimately to the taxpayers. But the level of insurance that's required for some of these jobs is absurdly high considering what you're doing. I could see if you're erecting steel, you might want a little bit more liability, which is understandable, than if you're planting grass seed.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure the city probably could help dissect it more. But I will agree that when it comes to particularly public jobs, and that's obviously a big public job, there are a lot of efforts to make certain that the governments, that taxpayers are protected and aren't held liable for various problems. That may be part of it. I apologize. I don't know enough because I don't know the details of the situation. But these liability issues are big deals. And went to my earlier point on having, in the case of the scaffold law, we have absolute liability rather than comparative negligence, and we're the only state in the nation that has it. So we're working to try to reduce that, which would reduce the cost of construction and hopefully allow our tax dollars to go much further.
All right, short break. We're going to come back. We had a caller who wanted an answer off the air, wanting to know what was done this session about poverty, especially in regards to kids in Rochester. We'll get the Assemblyman's take on that. Find out what else happened in the session and his take on some of the hotter issues coming out of Albany. This is Joe Morelli, the Assembly Majority Leader, and you on Connections on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we've mined the archives in celebration of our 30th anniversary as Rochester's NPR affiliate. WXXI AM 1370 was born on this day in 1984, and our panel will look back to the early days. We'll also examine the state of radio today and look at where broadcast is going. Happy birthday, AM 1370, coming up next hour on Connections.
Opening this week at the Little, Obvious Child tells the story of aspiring comedian Donna Stern, played by breakout actress Jenny Slate. Every day as a female 20-something provides material for her hysterical brand of humor, but when Donna winds up unexpectedly pregnant, she embarks on a hilarious and totally unplanned journey of self-discovery and empowerment. Huffington Post says Jenny Slate knocks this one out of the park, and in case it's not clear, it's very, very funny. See details at thelittle.org.
And welcome back to Connections. And we've got, let's go ahead and get Joe's answer to a caller who wanted to call and get an answer off the air. But Joe, she's asking, what was done this session, this legislative session, about poverty, especially in regards to children in Rochester?
Well, it's a great issue. I think a number of different things. One, during the budget, the city of Rochester received $6 million more than they've received in essentially unrestricted aid. But the mayor's argument was, we have a number of anti-poverty programs that we're working on, and we need help to support that. So that $6 million will really go towards that. That's obviously a short-term issue. I think there are longer-term issues here, and we tried to address these by investing more heavily in child care subsidies so that working poor can go to work and have a high-quality child care, a place for their children to go to, which allows them to work. That helps alleviate poverty. We've spent a considerable amount on pre-kindergarten in early childhood education, $330 million in new pre-K dollars, in addition to the amount we were already spending. That, again, is directed at long-term benefits. And one of the things that I'm doing locally, and I have to, you know, tip of the hat to the Children's Agenda, to the United Way, Rochester Business Alliance, I'm going to forget a lot of people, ANCRES at MCC has been to Rochester Area Foundation. We've pulled together something called the Children's Policy Council, something I've convened, and it's really asking those people heavily involved in childhood issues and childhood poverty to look at what issues children face, literally from prenatal care, the so-called cradle to career, to find out what barriers exist to us being successful. And we hope to put together a legislative agenda that deals directly with children's issues, particularly children in poverty, and unveil that over the next several months. We've been hard at work on it. We work with a lot of groups in this community who are already doing different things. But the one thing that I don't think there'd been enough of a focus on is public policy as it relates to the things that Rock the Future is doing and that a whole host of other groups are doing. So we've brought a lot of people together around this. Hopefully we'll hear more about it. Maybe I can even come on and talk at some length
with
some folks from the Children's Agenda and others that have been really critical in helping this together.
John in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Joe.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm doing good. Doing good. Joe, the Wage Theft Prevention Act, I thought I read that there was going to be some action taken on it, and the governor, it's on the governor's desk, the reform of the Wage Theft Prevention Act?
Yes, as a matter of fact, something that I was heavily involved in, my colleague and friend Carl Heastie, who chairs the Labor Committee, several years ago passed something called the Wage Theft Prevention Act, which was designed to try to stop this underground economy where wages weren't being reported or employees didn't know what their wages were. But for the vast majority of people, particularly in upstate New York, the disclosure requirements, in my view, were excessive and were burdensome to businesses, to not-for-profits, to our universities. So we've been working on a way to eliminate the annual disclosure and reduce those costs. We were successful. We passed the bill. Carl Heastie sponsored it himself as chair of the Labor Committee. We're very pleased. The Business Council of the state applauded it and supported it and were helpful in drafting it. The bill has passed both houses, and it's getting ready to go to the governor for action. I'm hopeful that the governor will sign the bill.
My understanding, just based upon what I read in the newspaper, the governor is a little hesitant to sign it, but didn't say either way, but he's got some hesitation for whatever reason.
I think the hesitation, John, was that one of the things that we require is that the state agencies, in terms of making sure that they're doing adequate enforcement of alleged improprieties on workforce violations, is in the bill. So I think the governor may be hesitant to take direction from the legislature on how to run his executive agencies. I'm hopeful we'll be able to resolve that. I have not heard that the governor's thinking of vetoing the bill, but I'm sure that that's part of the concern that he may have. But at the end of the day, this is the right thing to do. And I'm hopeful, even if the governor has some concerns about it, one of the ways that we deal with these perhaps disagreements between the governor's office and the legislature after we've passed a bill in both houses is to try to negotiate perhaps an amendment to it that might satisfy the governor and still leave the primary bill in place. So I'm sure we'll work on it, and I'll consult with Carl Heastie and others about how we make sure the governor passes the bill. I think it's an important piece of legislation.
John, does that answer your question?
Just one more point, Joe. So I'm assuming as part of this, the annual reporting requirement will be taken out?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thanks, John. Appreciate the call. Joe, and again, if you're just joining us, Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli is our guest for the hour, taking stock of the recent legislative session and some of the hotter state issues. It wasn't all that crazy of a session. It wasn't that much drama. There was some drama surrounding medical marijuana that was more in the hands of Governor Cuomo and some of his objections. They were satisfied. The state passed medical marijuana. New York becomes the 23rd state that will allow it, starting roughly around the beginning of 2016. But it'll be the only state that allows medical marijuana to not allow smoking of it. Are you okay with that?
I am personally, yes. I actually talked to the governor about this when we were negotiating the bill. And I recognize that there are, this is sort of an interesting issue. If you'll pardon me for just a second. I mean, on one hand, we're working very hard to deal with the heroin epidemic. And did a whole package of bills.
I know you passed legislation on that, yes.
Big deal. Very multifaceted approach. Very proud of the work that we did on this. It involves treatment. It involves penalties for distribution. It involves a lot of important things and elements to it. So we're doing that at the same time that we're, you know, sort of legalizing the use of marijuana under certain circumstances. And the governor felt, and I agreed with him, that we would be sending mixed messages to really open the door here, that we ought to try, you know, sort of a modest start. Let's see where this goes. You know, as you know, there has been some criticism. We allow only 5 vendors. I think each of the vendors will be able to open and operate under pretty strict control, 4 operations each. So you might have 20 facilities that
20
will grow.
Dispensaries, right?
Dispensaries, yeah. Right. So,
which probably won't cover all the need the doctors will have.
Well, it may not. And so what will happen as we measure the success of this is we may expand it. In fact, one of the things I thought we did, which was pretty progressive and smart, was we gave authorization to the Commissioner of Health to expand those ailments which you could prescribe for. So rather than having it in statute where we'd say ALS and certain types of cancer, et cetera, we allow the Department of Health to make that judgment, the commissioner. So I think that will allow it to be a dynamic statute. And look, you know, there are a number of people in the medical community who still have pretty mixed feelings about smoking marijuana and what it does to your respiratory system. You know, we've done this big public campaign about getting people not to smoke cigarettes. Not all of those negative effects of smoking cigarettes apply to marijuana, but many of them do. It does have an impact on your respiratory system. So I think we were just concerned. And there it seems to be pretty strong evidence that the vaporization or oils can get into the bloodstream nearly as fast, in some case vapors, they say, as fast.
Well, a couple of things on this. First of all, chemo kills a lot of healthy tissue, right?
That's true. There's no question.
I mean, there are certain treatments that we have that are not perfect.
Correct.
We had on Monday on this program, we had Dr. Luke Pappone, who is from the Wilmot Cancer Institute. He's a researcher who's been researching not only medical marijuana, but other plant-based treatments, et cetera. He told us 2 things. He said, number one, the difference between using marijuana as an oil and smoking it is huge. And there are certain conditions, especially pain and nausea, that all of the evidence so far indicates smoking is much more effective. Number two, I want to listen to some of what Dr. Pappone said. So this is Dr. Luke Pappone talking about his concerns about what he views as the state passing medical marijuana but limiting research. He wants more research done. Let's listen to what Dr. Pappone said about that.
Even though the state has made it legal, we still can't research it unless we get marijuana from the federal government. You cannot use the state's supply. I want to see the state help us to navigate this very treacherous research process.
What do you make of that?
Well, I make of it, I understand a researcher's desire to have more dollars from the state of New York go towards it. But obviously we have a lot of requests for money and a lot of needs that are being unmet as it is. And look, you know, I think of it a little bit this way, and this is my own narrow view, I'm sure, and I'll probably get calls and letters and emails about this. This is not a therapy to cure any illness. It is, and you know, I have family members who are taking chemo right now, so I know the effects of this is very, very significant and important. This is a way to limit the negative impacts of chemo. I'm not underestimating that
palliative,
to any degree. Right, it's palliative care. And so most of our research dollars, and I spent a lot of effort and we were successful in increasing research dollars to spinal cord injury, et cetera. You know, the federal government really does have more responsibility for research than the state. Our resources are much more limited. So I understand his point of view, but I think it's probably not likely that we would change this, certainly in the near future. But I do think the marijuana, you know, in a sense, I see this as an experiment. It may be halting in the way we've approached it, but I think people felt comfortable. This is a way to start. Let's see how this goes. If we need to expand it, there will be plenty of opportunities to do that. But I think this was sort of the comfort zone of a lot of members. And frankly, I think a lot of people in the public, I think this will be an appropriate way to start this.
And again, for our listeners, 18 months out, really. So we're looking at roughly the beginning of 2016 for medical marijuana in New York State. This is Mike in Rochester. You're on with Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, Mr. Morelli, I guess I want to ask you a history question. I guess every small town has a Civil War monument, but what is the Civil War monument that's in Albany that is dedicated to a general?
Geez, I'm sorry. I'm going to tell you this. We have in the Capitol, in the flag room, the largest collection of Union flags anywhere in the United States. But I believe it or not, Mike, I actually don't get to tour around Albany very much. I'm sure I'm going to regret having not knowing this answer.
I wouldn't have any
You're
going to
tell me what it is, yeah. Right, Mike?
I asked you this 8 years ago. I thought you would have...
Is it right in front of the Capitol? Is it right in front of the Capitol?
He's the general in front of the Capitol.
Yes, I am aware. And he was killed in battle?
1916 was significant because as a history buff, we don't realize that the Civil War was fought through monuments. And the Phil Sheridan Monument was established in reaction to a Birth of a Nation. So as the South was still celebrating the Civil War through movies, in New York, they decided, well, let's put Phil Sheridan up in front of the Capitol. So
you know, Mike, I think you did ask me that question before, and I apologize.
It's all coming back to you now.
It didn't stick in my brain, but I don't know why General Sheridan should be burned into my skull. I apologize that I didn't remember that.
Mike, thank you for the call. And I suspect now, 8 years from now, when you
sit here
back in this program, no, this time you will, I think. We've had some news this week in the courts. The highest court in this state made a decision on hydrofracking, and I'm always careful with this because there's certain things that are sort of in your legislative purview and certain things that aren't. But when it comes to hydrofracking, first of all, I assume you were following the home rule case at least to see what happened. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to go through all of the specifics for our listeners in terms of what that decision is all about. But a quick take on that case and the decision that was made, Joe.
Well, as I understand it, the decision dealt with a provision in the state law that relates to whether or not local governments can impose regulations on certain state-regulated activity. And the courts ruled that that's not what these bans were, but that local zoning did allow them to have a moratorium on fracking or a ban on fracking.
Right.
So, and the Court of Appeals is the final word in the state of New York as it relates to the constitutionality of laws like this. So this will stand. I assume what this means is local governments, local communities are going to have a great deal of say on whether fracking happens, even if the state allows it through a regulatory process. And we haven't given any permits. I don't think the state will take this issue up to the state health department until there's a new commissioner in place. I don't expect that to happen until 2015 at the earliest, I wouldn't expect. So I think the state question is still very much at issue, but there's no question that the Court of Appeals has said local governments can impose a moratorium or ban on fracking in local communities.
All right, so two quick questions based on that. Would the legislature then revisit that to try to change the legal language that would – essentially what I'm asking is the court has made a decision on this. Home rule, a town, yes, you can ban fracking within your town. And the way I read it and the way the attorneys have said is that now for that to change now, that is the final word unless the legislature did something different. Does the legislature have an appetite to do anything regarding that?
Well, I think it's not likely the state assembly has an appetite. We've passed a moratorium on fracking. I wouldn't expect that would change. I don't know about that. I wouldn't speak for the Senate, but I don't think that would change in the near future on our end. And, you know, this is to the point that the gentleman raised earlier about a constitutional convention. These are the kinds of questions because a constitutional convention could change the rule and could do that without legislative activity, but a change in the Constitution could affect this.
Sure. Okay, and then the other question then becomes, isn't it likely now that Governor Cuomo has the cover to say, all right, let's allow fracking in the communities that want it?
You know,
green light where you want it, and if you don't want it, you don't want it. Leave it up to the locals.
It is a very – and it's actually what – that's the conclusion that I came to when I was reading the opinion, which I think was written by Justice Graffio. That this does give you an out. I mean, if it depends on which way you look at it, which side of the issue you're on, you can now say, okay, we'll issue permits. They'll be highly regulated, and we will only do those in those communities that haven't imposed a moratorium or ban. And now you have the courts essentially giving you the ability to say that. So if a local community comes to you or a county or a town, village, and says, we don't want fracking in our community, the governor can now say, there's fine. The courts have ruled. You pass a resolution at your town board, your village trustees pass a resolution. We won't issue permits in those communities.
So that's a possibility. Then the one other flip side of that is what if you've got, say, a southern tier community that is sort of rich with shale gas, and they pass a moratorium. And then the next year, the town board changes. They lift the moratorium. Drilling begins. 2 years later, new people are elected. Is the industry going to be deterred if there's a back and forth?
I would think so, because you're going to have to significantly invest dollars, and so you're not going to be putting dollars into a community where there's a question about whether or not they're going to pass moratoriums in the future. You just won't invest the millions of dollars necessary to do that. And look, you know, there may be neighboring communities who say, okay, we've passed a ban in our town. The neighboring town hasn't, but that has a huge impact on us. So it's still going to be, you know, there's still going to be state involvement. But it did. But the question that you raised and that perspective did occur to me when I was reading the opinion that it actually may lead some people to argue, okay, well, now you can do it at the local level, so there's no need for the state to have to take up the question in a bigger sense. We just make sure that the regulations are appropriate.
2 days ago when we were talking to Minority Leader Brian Kolb, we asked him what did not get done in this session that needs to get done. I'll ask you that same question in a minute, but first I want to play you some of what he said to get your take on it. He talks a lot about the SAFE Act, and as you know, a lot of your Republican colleagues aren't happy with the SAFE Act. And Assembly Minority Leader Kolb told us that what the state assembly and what the state legislature has failed to do is pass anything in regards that is comprehensive that relates to mental health and gun ownership. Let's listen to what Brian Kolb said about that on Monday.
Well, first and foremost, you got to have people at the table to design or to provide input, Evan, quite frankly, that are mental health professionals. I am not. I'm a legislator, and when you're talking about crafting legislation, you know, you really rely on a lot of different experts on a particular field or subject matter, depending upon what it is. And I think that's a starting point, that we should have had more public hearings from mental health professionals.
Okay, so he's saying that even outside of the SAFE Act, he doesn't think enough has been done in regards to mental health and gun ownership. Do you agree?
Well, it's an interesting question. There's always more that we can do, and I'm sure there's people in the healthcare community, mental health community, that would want us to do more, and I'm sure we can. Having said that, and part of Brian's approach, and I have enormous respect for Brian. We work very well together, and he's a terrific legislator. But some of this is driven by what if the SAFE Act didn't exist, but it does. And there are significant mental health provisions in there that relate to gun ownership of persons who are adjudged to be have some mental illness. So there's some things that we did do. Will we make it better over time? I certainly hope so. And should people who – it's hard to identify, I think, people who may become violent. I think that's what healthcare professionals would tell you. But the SAFE Act is here. It's going to stay here. I think most New Yorkers actually support the SAFE Act. I think those who don't are very passionate about it, as is understandable. And so I think they're louder. And I think they're more passionate about it. But I think if you asked New Yorkers broadly, I think there's actually more support for it. So I think you start from where we are, and can we continue to improve on it incrementally and make it better? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, the notion of incarcerating people before they commit violence is one of the hardest questions, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I wish, you know, it's fascinating to me. I think we all watch television, and whenever there's some violence, and there is a lot of it. Yeah. So I mean, we should be mindful of that's the whole point behind the SAFE Act, is try to limit it. But people, once someone has committed an atrocity, it's relatively easy to say, oh, I could see that coming. But there are a lot of other people who are disturbed, perhaps, who don't commit violence. And so it's hard. It's easier after the fact, obviously, than to determine before an act happens. And I think most healthcare professionals and mental health professionals would tell you it's really difficult, and I think they probably don't want the burden of trying to identify someone before they commit a violent act and say this one is prone to violence. It's probably easier in some cases, but let's not make it sound like it's really easy to do.
A few minutes left with Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli. So what didn't get done that you want to see prioritized going forward?
Well, I was actually pretty happy with the legislative session. There's always things that I would like to do more of. And, you know, one of the things that I'd like to see greater focus on going forward is workforce development and workforce training, and making sure our workforce development programs more align with opportunities out in the workplace. There are a lot of jobs right now that are going wanting because we don't have the proper programs in place to train people for jobs in the current environment. I think that's a big issue. You've seen this with advanced manufacturing, and I credit MCC for trying to do a lot of work in that regard. I mean, it's really sad when you have young people struggling to find opportunities and then opportunities to go wanting because we haven't done a good enough job in preparing them. So I'd like to see that, and I expect to spend more time on that. I'm going to spend a lot more time, as I mentioned, on children's issues and children, particularly in poverty. But I was pleased with the session, and I'm I'm pretty proud of the legislature and the governor for working together to get as much done as we did.
Remind our listeners where the minimum wage stands in the state.
Well, the minimum wage right now is on a path to be increased. That's existing law. We had talked about accelerating the increases. That didn't get done. There's also talk about differential minimum wage that will wait until next year. I have some real concerns about different minimum wages around the state. Perhaps New York City and the five boroughs is a place to start if we're going to do that. But I'm very concerned that you have a patchwork of different minimum wages, even within a particular county.
As we've said, this is our 30th birthday. Our next hour, we're celebrating 30 years signing on as Rochester's NPR affiliate and AM 1370. And I'm curious to know, 30 years ago, you were in politics.
I was just starting, yes. Okay. First elected to the county legislature.
I'm very curious to know, in 30 years, where has income inequality gone in this country?
You know, it's a very important issue. I think it's one of the
90 seconds, solve it, Joe. But I'm curious to know.
Well, part of what I just talked about is workforce training. I think we have to have a career and technical education path for children, young people, instead of strictly a Regents diploma as it's currently instructed. There's a great book, Capital in the 21st Century, that I'm just beginning to
Piketty?
Read. Yeah, which talks about income inequality, and I'm anxious to get through that. I think it's the big issue of the 21st century, not only in the state of New York, but nationally.
Piketty has said, and we're going to try to do a show on this in the future, yeah. One of his concerns is that income is going to be largely based more on your status and your family status and your connections, as opposed to your effectiveness as a worker, and we're moving more towards a 19th century system in terms of the inequality.
Which is interesting in that, you know, family connections have always mattered, I suspect. But, you know, we're driving people to say, look, in a knowledge economy, it's what you know is really, and making sure that your skills are compatible with the marketplace. So there's a lot of work we need to do on this.
Yeah, connections will always matter to some degree, but do you want that to be the chief driver of a person's outcome in terms of the workforce?
Of course not. Certainly not in a society where we pride ourselves on equal opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Majority Leader, that is, Joe Morelli, is always generous with his time, and we appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Evan. Always great to be with you.
All right, and for our listeners, once again, we had Brian Kolb, a Republican, on Monday. Joe today, getting both sides of the aisle, taking stock of the legislative session. Thanks for your interaction with that. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to go into the archives and hear what WXXI sounded like 30 years ago as we celebrate a birthday.